This is Steps to Value, and in this episode, we'll take a closer look at ransomware and what you can do about it. Electronic secure data is one of the five categories of value in the HIMSS Health IT Value Steps framework. That is, there is inherent value when data is available in electronic form. And to be useful, that data must remain confidential, it must maintain its integrity, and it must be available when needed. Many forms of malware erode the confidentiality of the data when breaches occur. Ransomware hasn't yet been shown to be widely used in this manner. Instead, it obliterates the data's integrity and availability by encrypting it. And unless you pay the ransom demanded, it has no value. Hi, I'm Rod Pihowski, Senior Director, HIS at HIMSS. And in just a minute, we'll talk to Fred Cox, Director of Information Security at Varian Medical Systems. Fred will share some great ideas on how to get ahead of the bad guys. First, a couple of quick items on security developments. First, the FTC has released an alert on email scams that reference the recent earthquakes in Ecuador and Japan. These scam emails may contain links or attachments that direct users to phishing and malware-infected websites. Donation requests from fraudulent charitable organizations are pretty common after major natural disasters. The U.S. Computer Emergency Response Team encourages users to review the FTC alert and the information they have on charity scams at consumer.ftc.gov. Ensure that your staff does not follow unsolicited web links or attachments in email messages. Of course, keep your antivirus and other computer software up to date as well. There's also a Better Business Bureau list for Ecuador earthquake relief. Check that out before making any donations. Also, new variants of ransomware continue to be discovered every week, and they're developing more sophisticated ways to elude detection. So, for example, new variants of the TeslaCrypt ransomware are now being delivered as attachments that appear to be shipping notifications. The new version of this ransomware attacks backups. It adds an increasingly growing number of file extensions that it attacks. It employs WScript to evade notice. And finally, it attempts persistency by pointing to new copies of itself by way of the Windows registry. Our guest for this episode is Frederick Cox, Director of Information Security for Varian Medical Systems, where he designs their information security architecture and HIPAA and high-tech compliance programs. Fred has over 30 years' experience in IT and information security, and he's worked in a variety of industries, including finance and healthcare. Fred was kind enough to join us by phone for this conversation on ransomware. So, Fred, how is ransomware different from other types of malware?
Ransomware goes only after your data. A lot of other malware, they seek to either steal your data in terms of a data breach, or they make your equipment denial of service attacks, so you can't use your equipment. They actually injure your computer and so on. You either have to go buy a new one or get it repaired and so on. But ransomware comes in and encrypts your data. It doesn't look at your data. It leaves your data on your machine. They just encrypt it using their encryption algorithm and, of course, their key to their encryption. And they go through and they encrypt your sensitive data so you can't see it. You can't use it. You can't open files. And then they write you, communicate with you in one way or another, and say, we've just done this, and if you want to get the de-encryption key or the key needed to decrypt the files and look at them again, you owe us so much money, and this is how they spell out, usually on the dark web with bitcoins, which are virtually untraceable, how they are to be compensated, and then you're stuck. You have to rely on the honor of thieves, which is a scary phrase in and of itself.
Indeed.
To give you the encryption key once you give them the money.
And there are instances where people have paid and have not received the encryption key, correct?
There are, yeah. The kind of interesting wrinkle that was mentioned by one of our executives was they were curious at how much money was changing hands in these events. And from what we can see in the news media, it's not a lot of money, $18,000, $28,000, $35,000. It's not millions. And their response was, then it must be amateurs that are doing this, because hospitals or healthcare professionals, that data is very dear to them. And to interrupt their ability to take care of a patient's needs because they don't know, for instance, in radiation oncology, if you're in the middle of a 30-step program, you need to know exactly how much radiation has been given to that patient up to the next treatment time. Too much radiation, you're going to do harm. Not enough radiation, you'll do harm in the sense that you won't be effective. So that data is very dear, and it's not unique to radiation oncology. It's everywhere, dentists, surgeons, and so on. And hospitals have deep pockets, so it's likely that, unfortunately, the pros may see that this is a lucrative vector. And unfortunately, in the near-term future here, there may be a lot more activity in ransomware with considerably more larger fines involved. But happily, there are some solutions that we can talk about certainly today to navigate our way through ransomware and take some steps that are reasonably cost-effective, downright inexpensive, I should say, and you can get traction and actually stop the stuff. So.
So
that's the good news.
Yeah, and at least there is some good news. Well, the ransomware spreads through lots of different vectors, and some of those can be social, and some can be technological, and you mentioned there are things that can be done. What can a healthcare organization do? How can they structure their defense program to be effective?
Yeah, really good question. From what we've been able to garner from the news media and our own experience is that the method of operation is the fraudster will scan the internet looking for non-hardened environments, looking for environments where the firewall has a bunch of open ports. It's clearly not doing its job. Looking for places where once they pass through the firewall, they discover that there's no antivirus either deployed, or if it is deployed, it's out of date, or the patch management applications are out of date, or maybe there's old operating systems. In general, a non-hardened environment. And so what you tactically want to do is become a hardened environment so you're not on their list of, gee, this would be an easy one to break in on, I'll remember that one. So you want to start by hardening your environment, and so they will not be able to penetrate your firewall. They will, if they do, they'll see you have antivirus or current patches, and other measures, intrusion detection system is invoked and functioning so that you have a hardened environment, and their likelihood of success decreases greatly in those environments, so you won't become a victim. In other words, you want to harden your environment so you don't get on the list in the first place. That said, what happens, people will talk a lot about phishing attacks where they'll open up an email, maybe it's in their junk box, and they're curious, it looks compelling, and it has a link, your credit card is over limits or something has happened, and click on this link and we'll help you out, and they do right away. And as soon as they do, the fraudster now is inside your network. With clicking that link, he's able to launch his malware or his ransomware and start going. And start going means he starts to look for, quite rapidly and automatically, he looks for file extensions. And so he can quickly discover if you have a large SQL database out there, that's what he's shopping for. That's his ideal finding is, and he'll use the typical default SQL database suffixes, and he will encrypt those files, and they'll end up being encrypted in a way that you can no longer open them. So what do they need to do? They need to harden their environment. They need to talk to their employees, whether emails or actually have seminars, training sessions, raise the awareness on the issue of ransomware and how it happens. That is, that tell them they're going to be updating their antivirus or they're going to be making some changes, and go through the email drill on the phishing once again and give them a refresher on how people will write emails that sound very compelling and all they ask you to do is click, and tell them to delete those emails and so on, raise their awareness so that they will do the right thing when they need to do the right thing.
And that's really, you know, those phishing type attacks, so those are really the easy way in because they don't require a lot of technical expertise.
Absolutely. Phishing attacks are prevalent because they work. They work over time. Part of our testing, we will write emails to employees, and they'll be fake emails, and they'll contain a link. And it's one of the more effective training techniques that link will, when they push on that link, it'll open up a screen that says, gotcha. You know, you shouldn't know. This is a training exercise, and this is an example of how phishing launches software. And it startles people to realize this is really true, but it does so in a harmless way, in that it doesn't injure any computer systems and so on. It's just a way of raising their awareness that can be quite effective.
Now, I've been asked this question before. What if my data is encrypted? Does that protect me?
Actually, no. They will encrypt on top of your encryption. So that's there are a number of ways that ransomware essentially alters your files. They will they can change, for instance, on a Microsoft Word .doc file, a .doc file, they can change that to .lol, and Microsoft doesn't know what to do. It can't open the file. It doesn't have its .doc suffix, and you'll usually get a message. You want to go out on the internet and see if there's some software that can read a .lol file. Well, of course, there isn't. So in addition to encryption, they can also change the suffixes, which they usually do anyway, as part of their ability just to make your data unusable.
And in the old days, those are the kind of pranks we used to do to each other across the internal network, but now it's much more serious business.
Yeah, because they're actually, it's one thing to walk up to an unattended workstation where somebody's left it open and as a fool a couple people by a rename. But it's quite another to affect patient safety by coming in and doing a ransomware issue where you could actually end up doing harm to a patient indirectly because a physician would no longer be able to serve the patient in a manner that would be helpful.
So let's talk a little bit about, let's say I realize I need to up my game. How do I explain this issue to the board of directors?
Very good question. In some respects, this is the ransomware events. For those who haven't been hit yet, there are solutions out there. Probably the most viable solution, in addition to hardening your environment and educating your people about the ransomware, is deploying something called context-aware whitelisting software. That is, you put on your computers a utility that only allows the executables that you have defined to run on that computer. So you'll allow, for instance, Microsoft Office documents to executables to run. You'll allow Adobe to run. You'll allow a lot of the Microsoft Exchange server to run. Those are all purposeful, normal executables that you will allow to run on that platform. You can then the context aware means that the software goes an additional layer and says, okay, in addition to the executables you defined, we will make sure that when a software member is trying to alter, a Microsoft Word document, we'll make sure that that is only Microsoft Office software. It's not some other unknown or not a Microsoft product trying to alter a Microsoft Office Word or Adobe trying to alter Adobe documents and so on. So it gives you an extra layer of protection. There's a couple interesting things that happen when you take the whitelisting approach. That is, you by defining the universe of executables that will run on your computer, you also exclude any unknown executables. And in today's signature-based antivirus malware or signature-based intrusion detection systems, both of those utilities use known definitions or known scripts, if you will, or known executables, and that's why every night you're supposed to get new definitions. That's really what a definition is to say, here, we've identified five more executables that are evil and they shouldn't run on your hardware. And that goes into the intrusion detection or the antivirus software, and it will scan in real time for those bad software members and not allow them to execute. The problem with that is what is called zero day. That is the new threat that hasn't been found by the laboratories yet and discovered as a virus or as a disingenuous piece of software. Those are the ones that do the damage. And every one of the signature-based intrusion detection device utilities or antivirus utilities, which is to say virtually all of them, they can't help you with the zero-day ransomwares or the zero-day viruses because they don't know they exist yet. They don't have a signature or an executable for that activity. The good news with whitelisting is whitelisting doesn't care. It says, Fred, you've told me that I can run these 18 or 55 executables, and that's all I can run. And this new one coming in, I don't know what it is, but it's not on your list, so it doesn't get to run. So not only do you take a more aggressive posture to manage the antivirus or intrusion detection risks, you also, for really the first time with a whitelisting approach, can go a long way to handling zero-day exposures, which is really a good thing. So you get kind of a secondary effect also with patch management. That is, you have a little bit of wiggle room in your patch management if you do use the whitelisting approach, meaning if we go back to, well, why do we patch manage? Well, we apply patches for operational stability because somewhere along the line we found the software is not stable and needs to be patched, and we'll get that done. And we also apply known security vulnerabilities, fix them in the operating system or the software we have so that malware has no place to land or malware can't take advantage of that weakness. Well, if we do whitelisting, then malware really can't take advantage of that weakness because it can't run anyway. Even if you don't have it patch managed and it downloads and loads itself because of that weakness in patch management, then when it tries to execute, the whitelisting cuts it off. So it gives you a little breathing room on patch management, which is genuinely good news in the healthcare community, where you have many of the medical devices that hospitals use, you cannot put them into a weekly Microsoft patch management cycle because the regression testing to make certain that the patch management process does not alter or adversely affect the performance of that device must be assured before you apply the patches. So that is, it's always been kind of a rub in hospitals to say, yeah, I'm sort of current in patch management, but not really because I can't run regression testing every week. I'll run regression testing every quarter. So in that sense, the software gets a little bit out of whack from a patch management standpoint. In this case, with the whitelisting, you can really protect yourself.
Yeah, and the whitelisting also really raises the awareness of, you know, what your environment looks like, and you have a pretty good inventory of what you've got, and you have justified why you want certain things to be, you know, allowed to be run.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So where do you think this is going, Fred? What's next? Is do you think healthcare can kind of fend off these attacks, or do you think it will increase? And what's next down the road? That, you know, how can people start to be more proactive?
I think probably the good news is that these discussions with senior management and the board will, particularly when you start talking about whitelisting, for instance, which is a technology that's been out there for, I don't know, at least 3 years that I'm aware of, that directly manages what they call the zero-day risks for malware. Heretofore, that the information security group sort of says to management, well, we have confidence in our antivirus and we have confidence in them as a provider and they do a great job and so on, but there are always these possibilities of a zero-day beating us, and so management know that we're doing the best we can, but there's always an option to be breached or defeated. And I think that it will tend to, because of this ransomware and getting a meaningful discussion going back and forth between the security group and senior management and or the board, you get a chance to explain risks and truly understand how to manage those risks. And when a guy in IT pushes back on whitelisting and say, boy, that's really tedious. I have to define and I have to run their whitelisting utilities, listing agents to discover all the executables, and sometimes it misses them. And so until we get that baseline of executables defined, we're going to have a couple hard stops, and it's a lot of work, and I'd rather not do that. And you can tell the guy, well, you know what? We're going to have a little bit of sweat here because the end result is so worth it that we'll take the couple hard stops that we get as we discover and build that baseline of executables. And we'll start to do a little bit better job when we initially build the software, build that computer before we're even using it, to discover and define all of the executables that are needed to run the thing in production. So that essentially what I'm trying to convey is I think this is going to help us up our game across the board in healthcare to get a better dialogue mechanism going where we can discuss risks that we actually face, not just in terms of probability or impact, but in terms of threatscape management, and reducing those threatscapes. So by running, for instance, whitelisting, you take zero-day vulnerabilities or zero-day viruses off the table. You've taken a huge chunk of threat landscape off the table by just simply taking a different approach. And having management understand that and say, you know, that's worth funding, I'll do that. It's not in our budget, but that's okay. This is truly a case of an ounce of prevention's worth a pound of cure. Let's do it. And you really get some traction going on, I think, is probably the best news from all this event.
Well, Fred, thank you very much for your time and being our guest on Steps to Value.
All right, Rod, thank you so much.
Fred offered an additional piece of advice. Even if you employ whitelisting, make sure you prevent the local user on workstations from having admin-level privileges. That type of access can be used to defeat your whitelisting and other technologies. Well, that's it for this episode of Steps to Value. I'd like to thank our guest today, Fred Cox. We didn't mention it before, but Fred is also a member of the HIMSS Risk Assessment Work Group. This episode was co-produced by Lee Kim. Our chief organizer and guest relations expert is Rhonda Frazier. If you have any comments, you can either email us at value@hims.org or leave them on our website as part of the blog post that accompanies this episode. I'm Rod Pihowski. See you next time on Steps to Value.